This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Ratchford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and UConn Health Orthopedic and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You are encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC, News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information and answers all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this Saturday morning, December 9th. And I'm really looking forward to today's show, especially because I'm going to be interviewing Dr. Rachel Geller. Dr. Geller is a medical doctor. She is an associate medical examiner and forensic pathology fellowship director for the Georgia Bureau of Investigation and their Division of Forensic Sciences. Now, we've all seen these television shows, right, with pathologists who dig through and try to find the source or the cause of a death. And as a medical student in Italy, I remember that pathologic anatomy was the single most difficult course to get through because you not only have to know the anatomy, but you have to describe the pathology you're seeing. So, great, this is a heart, but is this an infarction like a heart attack? Is it an infection? Then you have to describe the infection. So it's always a challenge in medical school, no matter where you are. And yet there are those physicians who go into this field, and I just see it as such a challenge. So this is the first time we're going to have a pathologist on the program. She's going to be joining us from Georgia at 11:20. This day in medicine, December 9th, 1748, Dr. Claude Louis Bartholet was born. So in 1748, he was a French chemist, and he researched the use of ammonia and chlorine compounds. And it brought to mind a recent interview I did for the Wall Street Journal. And that was, why are athletes using smelling salts on the sidelines? And the reporter who contacted me cited an article I wrote back in 2018 talking about the use of smelling salts as a growing concern then. So let's talk a little bit about it. I mean, smelling salts really go back to the Roman period, the Roman ages, and then became popular in the Victorian era for people who were fainting. I don't know about some of you listeners, but I remember when you used to go to a funeral home, if you went to a wake, they would have as a promotional item, it was a little box, and in it there would be three ampules. And in case somebody fainted, you would pop the ampule, and they would smell the smelling salts to hopefully revive them. And the theory there is that what happens when you faint or you become dehydrated, your heart slows and you get lower circulation to the brain, so you pass out. The idea of the smelling salts was to trigger a noxious stimulus, so something that would be so irritating that your body would jump or react to it and your heart would pick up its pace. And that was the theory, and in fact, I think it was effective for that. In the 1950s or so, we started to see a lot of boxers and fighters using smelling salts, like in between rounds, you might see it used in a movie, and there were people starting to use it for concussion. Now, it's been banned in boxing, and there's a reason we don't use it in sports. That reason being that when you pop that ampule, that noxious stimulus causes you to withdraw, to pull back. Often when you have head trauma, there's also neck trauma, right? When you imagine the head being jolted backward and extending the neck. So that sudden movement could result in severing the cervical spine. So with that, in sports, we have banned it from the use of concussion. It doesn't have a medicinal purpose in that. Now, the reason this reporter brought this to my attention was what I cited in 2018 has come back in vogue, and that is athletes using it on the sideline. And in this case, she cited the Michigan-Ohio State game where the acting head coach for Michigan actually used it on himself, and players are using it on the sideline to make them more alert. That's somewhat bizarre. Now, I can tell you I've never seen that used on any of the sidelines I've worked. But to think that with all the adrenaline going and all the intensity of a football game, that you would need something to get your heart pumping faster or become more alert is ironic, to say the least. So, is it harmful? No, not in that situation. Is it doing any good? No. But what happens is people see this being done, right? So younger athletes are watching a program or watching the game, and they see these fellows starting to use this, and all of a sudden they become, say, well, I need to get some of that and order it on the internet. So it's always a real problem from that standpoint in terms of its effect on younger athletes. So again, I did that interview a few weeks ago. I don't even know if the article came out, but it was quite a discussion about, you know, what to do and with this use of various small salts and things like that. But nevertheless, we remember this day in medicine back from 1748 when Dr. Bartholet was born. A couple of things I wanted to catch up on, and that is, and I think we'll do a little more detailed, but there's a new gene therapy for sickle cell disease. And as you know, sickle cell disease is a deformity of red blood cells, primarily seen in Africa, and thus in African Americans. With that, what we believe, and the theory is that people develop these abnormal cells as a response to malaria. And what happens is you typically have red blood cells that are round, very flexible, they can move easily through blood vessels. But instead, with sickle cell disease, what happens is the blood vessels are crescent-shaped, and they are become more rigid, so they have difficulty getting through blood vessels. And this leads to a variety of symptoms. They become anemic, but also leads to stroke, heart attack. A lot of pain is what we see. That is the most common symptoms. It could be chest pain, abdominal pain, but often we see a lot of joint pain, and it is a very intense pain. For someone to get this, they need to have, both parents need to have the trait to produce the abnormal hemoglobin. And in some people, you hear about the sickle cell trait, where they only have one of those genes. So they don't really develop the disease itself. And they believe that it's the trait that you will see that avoids malaria to some degree. The question becomes, treatment has been minimal so far. Basically, you recommend lifestyle changes such as water, drinking plenty of hydration, avoiding extreme temperatures of cold and heat, and avoiding exposure to altitude or situations where you have a low oxygen level. There are medications we use for pain, and obviously blood transfusions have been effective. It really came to light in sports in 2007. A Pittsburgh Steelers player by the name of Ryan Clark, who had the sickle cell trait and did not know it, was playing in Denver. As you folks may know, high altitude, right? Lower oxygen levels. He's playing, developed severe abdominal pain that eventually led to an infarction of one of the arteries in his abdomen, and he had to have his spleen and gallbladder removed. Now, this led to mandatory screening now for the NCAA. So in the NCAA, all athletes, no matter what your sport is, you have to be screened for sickle cell trait. And it's kind of interesting because when you have a rule like that, I mean, it has to apply to everyone. So it's not just African-American athletes. I mean, we'll have Scandinavian golfers who get screened as well. So the point is, the new breakthrough is a gene therapy. And I hope we're going to get one of our experts on to talk a little bit more about it. But basically, as you remember, genes are basically a recipe for making proteins. And it makes this hemoglobin. With the new gene therapy, it can alter the gene so that it does not make the abnormal hemoglobin. It doesn't require a donor. It just requires this therapy that can take several months, but it will result in normal hemoglobin being produced in these folks. This is a tremendous, tremendous breakthrough in medical science, and we'll be talking more about it in the future. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back with my guest today, Dr. Rachel Geller. Dr. Geller is a medical examiner. She is associate medical examiner and forensic pathology fellowship program director at the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. We're going to be talking about forensic science. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. And as always, if you have questions for me, you can get them to me live while we're on the air at info@alessimd.com. As I mentioned, my guest today is Dr. Rachel Geller, who is Associate Medical Examiner and Forensic Pathology Fellowship Program Director at the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, their Division of Forensic Sciences. This gives me great personal pleasure. I know Dr. Geller since she went to school with my daughter, my oldest daughter, in Norwich. And more importantly, her father, Dr. Richard Geller, has been an outstanding pediatrician and has provided such excellent care to the children of Norwich for over 35 years. And he's still working, as am I. Rachel, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dr. Alessi. Thank you for having me.
So let's talk about you a little bit. Let's talk. You know, you're the first pathologist I've ever had on the show. It's one of those fields that everybody's intrigued by, right? Otherwise, it wouldn't be in all the movies and TV shows. But I don't know if a lot of people know. What's like your education and training? What does it take to become a medical examiner, a forensic pathologist?
Okay, I am happy to talk about myself. Thank you for the opportunity. I attended Norwich Free Academy, and I graduated in 2001. Then I went to the University of Virginia, where I actually studied studio art. I took my prerequisites for medical school at the University of North Carolina in Charlotte while I was working, and then I attended Wake Forest University School of Medicine to get my MD. So medical school is a four-year program, and then that was followed by 4 years of anatomic and clinical pathology residency. That is the in anatomic and clinical pathology residency, I learned how to diagnose cancer, I learned how to examine organs, I learned how to do autopsies, and I was primarily in the hospital. However, after anatomic and clinical pathology residency, I did a one-year fellowship in forensic pathology at the Fulton County Medical Examiner's Office, where I studied forensic pathology exclusively.
So can you tell our listeners, what is forensic pathology?
Well, let's start. Let's start with pathology in general. Pathology is the study of disease. And so there are different components of anatomic pathology, like looking at pap smears or looking at all of the organs that come out of the operating room in surgical pathology, for example. There's also clinical pathology, where we run blood banks and chemistry labs and microbiology labs. A branch of anatomic pathology is forensic pathology, which looks, which examines disease and trauma as it relates to death. So a forensic pathologist is a person who performs autopsies to determine cause and manner of death, especially in cases where there may be suspicious death.
So let's talk a little bit about that, because first of all, in order to do this and look at suspicious death, you have to have an autopsy.
Yes.
And you are on the record in a wonderful MedPage article back in 2022, highlighting the fact that there are fewer autopsies being performed. Why is that? And can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, in hospitals, for example, autopsy is not reimbursed. So every time a hospital does an autopsy, they lose money. An autopsy is so important because it's necessary for improving quality of care. That's where you find where your medical mistakes are made. But because people don't get paid to do them in the hospital, their numbers are decreasing. So you have fewer and fewer medical students and fewer residents exposed to autopsy in their various years of training. As a result of that, fewer people are becoming interested in forensic pathology. So we have a critical shortage of forensic pathologists in the United States. We need about 1,200 forensic pathologists right now, but we only have maybe 750 practicing.
Really? I didn't know that.
Well, it's, you know, we're picking up the slack. We just do some extra work when we can. I am routinely covering other offices outside of the office that I am primarily working at in our state, so that people in areas without a forensic pathologist or with not enough forensic pathologists can find out what happened to their loved ones and that they can get their death certificates in a timely manner.
So do some people just say, listen, I want an autopsy and I'm going to pay for it? I mean, when did they ever pay for autopsies? Was it ever a reimbursed procedure, or has it never been?
I think a decade ago, Medicare did reimburse these, but they have stopped. And you can get a private autopsy if you want one. But we, as medical examiners, we operate outside of the health insurance system. We are mostly government employees who are paid by the taxpayer, and our job is to examine, at least in Georgia, I examine patients that are under our jurisdiction under the Georgia Death Investigation Act. So where I work now, coroners will refer cases to us, and we'll talk about the case, and we'll say, oh, does this person need an autopsy? Maybe they just need an external examination. Maybe they don't need to come in at all. And we will perform autopsies on whoever we determine needs to have one.
So you've touched on a big question that I've always had. What is the difference between a coroner and a medical examiner?
Well, a coroner is an elected official, and they are charged with investigating death. And a forensic pathologist is a doctor who has specific training in forensic pathology, but we aren't elected. I don't know if I could get elected. I'm just a regular person.
Okay. So a coroner's usually law enforcement people, or what? I'm just going to run for coroner. I mean, there must be some expertise involved in that.
There is a coroner training and coroner school. And Yeah, there's training to become a coroner that you can take. And some people come from the funeral home background. Some people do come from a law enforcement background. But we work really closely with coroners who often they'll go to the scene. They'll be our eyes and ears. They'll investigate for us. There's some jurisdictions. So there's two types of jurisdictions. There's the jurisdictions where the coroner is the elected official who partners with forensic pathologists, but the coroner at the end of the day is in charge of the investigation and ultimately signs the death certificates. And then there's medical examiner jurisdictions where the medical examiner system is without coroners, and there will be medical legal death investigators who work for the medical examiner system, and those investigators will go out to the scene and be the eyes and ears for the forensic pathologist. I typically don't go to scenes. I've been to a couple, but I my happy place is in the morgue.
Well said, I guess. With that, we're going to take a short break, and we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. Rachel Geller. I have so many more questions for her. We want to walk us through a typical day, and really find out what attracted her to this field. Then we want to get into a little bit of the nitty gritty of how has DNA changed things? How has this field evolved? If you have questions for me, you can reach me at info@AlessiMD, and we will share those questions with Dr. Geller. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's my great pleasure to have as my guest Dr. Rachel Geller, who is a forensic pathologist. Rachel, I guess one of the things we'd like to know a little bit about is what attracted you to this field, to go into forensic pathology?
Okay. I don't know if I have a great answer. I liked everything in medical school. I liked absolutely everything. I loved delivering babies. I really liked surgery. I liked working with my hands. But when I rotated with the forensic pathologist, I felt like I found my people. I could still work with my hands. I was able to look at tissues under the microscope, so I could recognize different disease patterns, which for me made a lot of sense as somebody who's very passionate about painting and has the brain of an artist. But I think for me, it was solving the medical mysteries that was most attractive. But I can't say that there was something, I don't know how to explain it. When I talk to the medical students that I'm recruiting into the field, I tell them, you'll know in 10 minutes if this is for you. It's a calling almost.
Do you find, I think you brought up a good topic, and that was you found your people. And I think that was true with me, and I think a lot of people is you kind of find where your personality and where your skill set kind of fit in by the people you're around. Do you find that true in pathology? Because it's got to take clearly a certain personality to go into that.
Oh, absolutely. And I think we get we're treated very unfairly by the media. The TV shows, most of
really?
The pathologists. Yeah,
I wanted to get into that. Okay. Are the TV shows accurate?
Well, I think they make us look a lot nerdier than we are. And I mean, I'm a nerd, but I'm a well-adjusted nerd. I have a family. I like talking to people. I just happen to really like my microscope. But I think in some of the TV shows, they always show the morgue in the basement, and it's dingy and it's dark. First of all, you can't perform an autopsy in the dark. Okay. You need good lighting to do an exam. And we've always had natural light and windows everywhere I've worked. The place has always been spotless. And the pathologists that I've worked with have been well-rounded, good-natured people who may just value their sleep more than other doctors who like to go out in the middle of the night.
Well, then it leads me to another question. What makes a good forensic pathologist? In other words, you know, when people are living, right, you could judge by, well, this person does these great, difficult surgeries, or, you know, he always finds a cure for some infectious disease. I mean, what makes somebody like big league in the field of forensic pathology?
Ooh, I think a good forensic pathologist is a doctor who is both competent and very curious. An excellent forensic pathologist will stop at nothing to uncover the truth of what happened to their patient. Can they testify effectively? You know, can you communicate difficult ideas in a way that anybody can understand? I think that is so important for a forensic pathologist, because so much of our life is spent talking to juries.
I was going to ask you that. I mean, how often do you have to, you know, go in front of a jury, go to court?
Well, this year, or in the year and a half since I started working at the GBI, I think I've testified about 20 times. So every couple weeks, I have another court case. And when I was working at the other offices I've worked at, when I first worked at Fulton, but I was a little baby forensic pathologist then, and my cases did not go to trial for a year or two after I performed them. And I then worked at DeKalb County Medical Examiner's office during the COVID pandemic, so the courts were shut down. And so we have a backlog of old cases that are all coming to trial now. So I testify quite a bit, but I think it'll probably shake out eventually that I'll testify once a month.
Okay. Can you walk us through a typical day for a pathologist?
Sure. So forensic pathologists have both days on service and days doing paperwork. So on a day that I'm on service, I'll usually come in around 7 or 7:30, and I'll go right into the morgue. I'll say good morning to everybody, and I will work with death investigation specialists who are cross-trained as investigators and autopsy techs. So I'll talk with the death investigation specialist about what our plan will be for the day. I won't be the only doctor in the morgue, but I will have maybe 3 to 5 cases that I need to do. There might be 2 other doctors on service, and we'll also have our fellows that we are training performing autopsies under supervision. So I'll check out my cases. I'll read the investigative reports. I'll review any X-rays associated with their cases. I typically have at least one homicide that I will examine. The first thing I like to do is get fingernail clippings and head hair on my homicides, collect trace evidence. I'll examine their clothing for gunshot wound defects. And then I'll get external information. I take over the bodies. So I will walk around with my gloves, and I'll examine each of my patients externally. And then I usually have a shadow come shadow me starting at about 9, because I'm really working hard to recruit medical students into the field. So I'll typically have a helper starting at 9 a.m. And then I'll start my autopsies, and I'll complete the internal examination of each patient. We put the organs back in the body, and then we send them on their way. Usually I'll be done by 1:30. We'll call back coroners with cause and death if we can. And then I usually have a meeting with a district attorney or a defense attorney around maybe 1:45, 2 o'clock. And then we'll have a 2:30 case discussion with the doctors, where we go over all of the cases from the previous days. Because we don't want to, a hospital pathologist won't assign a new diagnosis of cancer to a patient without discussing that with another doctor. And similarly, we like to have consensus on all of our cases to make sure that nobody's missing anything and that we're making the right decisions. And then usually I have to leave by 4:45 to get my tiny human from daycare. So that is a day in the life of a forensic pathologist.
So what? Rachel, one of the things I guess you brought up, I didn't realize, so with a cancer diagnosis, sometimes they're getting a second opinion from you, is what it essentially comes down to.
Well, not necessarily from me, right? But like, let's say you work in a hospital, and I should have been more clear. Let's say you're not a forensic pathologist. Let's say you're a surgical pathologist and you're in the hospital. If you want to make a diagnosis of cancer, typically you will discuss that with other doctors after you've done all of your testing to make sure you've come to the right conclusion. And similarly, in our field, if we have a difficult case, we want to talk to other doctors in consensus to confirm that what we are calling manual strangulation, for example, is indeed manual strangulation, or that what looks like it could, is it a suicide or a homicide? Are we making the right call? So we don't make our decisions in a vacuum. Our words have a lot of consequences, so we have to be right.
How many autopsies are you doing in that typical day where you say you examine the bodies, but how many autopsies are you typically doing in one day?
Typically between 3 to 5. I have done about 380 this year. I want to give every patient 100%. And so sometimes it takes me a while to get my reports out. But, you know, I explained to the coroners, I'd rather be maybe a little bit slower and right than rushed. And, you know, I don't like cutting corners on anything. So,
that's appreciated. I mean, actually, and I think you brought a good point that medical examiners typically kind of like a dog on a bone. I mean, a good medical examiner probably just wants to just get to the bottom of the darn thing.
Absolutely.
Let's talk a little bit about forensic pathology itself. Can we talk a little bit about the evolution of that? Because I want to get into DNA, dental records, some of the tools you use. But really, I mean, forensic pathology, as far as I recall, I mean, it's really only been a field since the mid-1800s. Am I correct?
Well, autopsies have been going on for a really long time.
Yeah.
So even in ancient Greece, I guess people were doing autopsies, but not forensic autopsies.
Right.
I think there's been an evolution of the coroner system in England, and then in our country we've had both coroner system and medical examiner system. But autopsy, an autopsy hasn't really changed too much over the years. The actual performance of autopsy is pretty standard, but like you're alluding to, the development of forensic science has been enormous for our field. So, I mean, probably the most, well, I was going to say the most important tool that we use is X-ray. We have full body X-rays that we can perform in 13 seconds. In our office. So if you're trying to find bullets, X-ray is incredible. But my chief medical examiner would correct me and say the most important tool we have is the telephone, because you can always ask more questions. You can talk to families. You can talk to coroners. You can talk to detectives. And a lot of times the answer may not be in the body, but it may be in the investigation.
We all hear about DNA now. In terms of really, I mean, in terms of finding criminals, it's been pretty amazing. But we also hear about mistakes with DNA and that it's not foolproof. How does that play into all this? I mean, I find it puzzling, to say the least.
Absolutely. And I don't have all the answers, but I'll do the best I can. So for us, typically, the DNA that we mostly use DNA for identification purposes. Let's say somebody is found in the woods, decomposed, they don't have features of identification anymore. We might collect femur or even fingernails, and we will submit their tissues for DNA sequencing. And then the forensic scientists will compare the sequence of the DNA that our patients have to a known sample from a person that, you know, maybe has reported them missing or typically like an immediate family member. You can also compare the decedent's DNA to a database called NAMIS, which is the National Missing and Unidentified Persons System. And that's a great way to identify, you know, Jane Doe's and John Doe's from many years ago. In terms of collecting DNA for trace examination or trace DNA for examination for solving crimes and who hurt another person, we don't often submit samples for that purpose, just because for most of our cases, most of our homicides are gunshot wound homicides, and there isn't necessarily a need for that. I mean, many of our homicides are actually, sometimes they'll be on security camera at a gas station, so there might not be DNA needed in that situation. But we do, for a lot of our gunshot homicides, one of the really important things we have to do is collect any bullets that are left in bodies. And the rifling or the marks on the jacket of the bullet can be compared to say, you can test fire a bullet through the gun, through the same gun, and the gun will always leave like a fingerprint on the bullet. So we'll collect a bullet. Our scientists in firearms will test fire bullets through the gun that is thought to have been associated with that crime, and they can find a match. And what's pretty wild is sometimes if a gun has been used in other crimes, there's a database for that, and you can link the gun to multiple crimes, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So is something like that, or even identifying a John Doe or Jane Doe, is that a big rush for a forensic pathologist? Is that like, does that make you feel really good at the end of the day?
I mean, it definitely makes me feel like I did something important, but I guess I outed myself as a nerd earlier. My favorite thing is solving a medical mystery. So I've had cases where
one. Okay, let's go. What? Because I was going to get to this question.
You may be familiar with my biggest medical mystery.
Was that the MedPage case?
Yes.
That's a great case.
I would be honored. When I was working at the DeKalb County Medical Examiner's Office, I performed an autopsy on a young boy was thought to have died from COVID. I had performed dozens and dozens and dozens of autopsies on people who died from COVID. And what is reported as COVID did not always turn out to be COVID. I had a case, for example, that was reported as COVID and the lady had metastatic cancer. I had another case that was reported as COVID and the lady had undiagnosed AIDS. So I have an open mind when somebody tells me that somebody died from COVID. When I performed this autopsy on this young boy, I knew immediately perhaps he had COVID, but that was not all that he had. He had.
And the parents were the ones who insisted on this autopsy, right? It was refused previously?
Yes. There was a time when hospital pathologists and even forensic pathologists were not performing autopsies on patients with COVID because of concerns about infection. But, you know, I feel like this is my. Infectious disease autopsies are in my wheelhouse. This is what I was probably born to do. So I, when I had the opportunity to help this family, I couldn't say no. So I performed the autopsy on this little boy. And of course, you know, I would hope that a doctor would care about me if, God forbid, something happened in my family. You know, so we take the autopsy very seriously, and we want to preserve the body and keep the body presentable. So,
sure.
Like we hide incisions so that you can still have an open casket. We're just very cognizant of how the next of kin is going to feel when their loved one comes back after we've examined them. But anyway, I digress. So for this little guy, I did his autopsy and I took out his lungs and I knew that he had something else. He had innumerable abscesses in his lungs, and I swabbed one and I sent it to Grady, the local hospital, to have to determine what type of bacteria had caused these abscesses, because COVID isn't going to cause abscesses. So I knew something else was going on. And all in all, I got the results back. This little guy had something called Burkholderia pseudomallei, which causes melioidosis, which is fatal in maybe 50% of cases, even with treatment. And he had become sickened by a contaminated product that had been purchased at a big box store. And so we were able to provide closure to the family, but it also led to a recall of this product to protect other people who could potentially be exposed.
It was an amazing case. And that's just, I guess, what it's all about. Well, in closing, what's something that most of the listeners and myself don't know about forensic pathology that we should know about either now or coming in the future?
Well, I think the most important thing to know is that forensic pathology is primary care. The case I just spoke with you about, you know, that will be with me for the rest of my life. And I think to be able to help his parents and provide closure, but also help others in the setting of public health. That's a really meaningful thing for me. And I would hope for anybody, right? But we are all going to die, and we have put death in this box outside of, you know, our daily life. But our loved ones, you know, will deserve closure, and we need to realize that our choices that we make in life affect how we will die, right? Like, we need to eat healthier. We need to exercise more. I need to exercise more personally, but we need to be cognizant of how we can prevent heart disease. How can we prevent COPD, lung cancer? And, you know, I think it's essential to learn from autopsy how Americans are dying and what we can do to make our health better.
Rachel, thank you. Thank you for taking time. I know it's a busy Saturday, especially with a young one who's having a birthday today. So,
yes.
Thank you very much. And please give my best to your dad.
Thank you. We are. My husband is picking him up from the airport right now. Thank you so much, Dr. Alessi.
Thank you, Rachel. We're going to wrap things up right here. Many thanks to Dr. Rachel Geller for her time today. Many thanks to our studio producer. Kevin Kors has been on the board. Jeff Chandler's in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. Next week on Healthy Rounds, we will be live once again with Dr. Corey Dwyer. He is an orthopedic surgeon specializing in sports and particularly in shoulder injuries. So if you have questions for him, you can reach me at info@alessimd.com. If you missed any part of today's program, you can get it on the Healthy Rounds podcast, and you could download it at odyssey.com. Next up on WTIC is going to be Law Talk with attorney John Matulis. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Rochford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.